Thank you for listening to this Podcast One Sportsnet production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
The NFL season may be over, but the action in the NBA, college basketball, and NHL is heating up. There's only one place to get in on the action, and that's betonline.ag. Create a free account on betonline.ag and receive a 50% sign-up bonus just by using the promo code PODCAST1. Betonline.ag, online sportsbook experts and exclusive partner of Podcast One Sportsnet.
The following program is a PODCAST1.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I am currently out on vacation recharging batteries, but just because I'm recharging the batteries, we still got business to take care of. In the meantime, we'll be playing some of the most requested Steve Austin Show classics that have been locked away in the archives. I got a great one for you this week, and here's my producer, Sean, to tell you all about it.
Oh, it's true. It's damn true. It's another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show. Producer Sean here bringing you episode number 18 with the Olympian and WWE Hall of Famer Kurt Angle. Original air date June 6th, 2013. This is the first of two times that Kurt was on the Steve Austin Show, and it's about 4 years before he returns to the WWE and goes into the Hall of Fame and eventually returns to the ring. At this point, he's still in TNA. He was just inducted into the TNA Hall of Fame and wrestled AJ Styles at Slammiversary 11 the same night. And they're about to embark on the new Main Event Mafia with Kurt Angle and Sting and a few other guys. I believe Samoa Joe and Rampage Jackson were in that group. So that's where we're at for today's classic episode with Kurt Angle. It's a lot of good stuff. They talk about neck surgery and Kurt getting into WWE and how he almost quit immediately, which is actually a pretty funny story that I don't think I've ever heard before. Also, Steve and Kurt get into the incident where Kurt Angle made an appearance at the ECW arena, I believe back in 1996. And Kurt's talked about this before on other DVDs and stuff like that, but there was an incident that went on in the ring that Kurt did not like, so he got pretty heated about it. And you'll hear about it on this podcast. So this day in Steve Austin history, February 12th, was a busy day for Steve Austin. He had quite a bit going on in WCW and in WWE. So check this out. 1992, at the WCW Saturday Night / Main Event taping at the Center Stage in Atlanta, Steve Austin interfered in the Ricky Steamboat, Barry Windham versus Arn Anderson, Larry Zbysko match that was taped for WCW Saturday Night. And then for an episode of the Main Event, Steve Austin, Bobby Eaton, and Rick Rude defeated Sting, Marcus Alexander Bagwell, and Ricky Steamboat. And if you're an audience member, Blimpies provided free lunch for you. Very cool. Also in 1993 in Houston, Texas, in a WCW Tag Team title match, Ricky Steamboat and Shane Douglas defeated the Hollywood Blondes, Steve Austin and Brian Pillman. Let's jump ahead to 1998 in Miami, Florida. Stone Cold Steve Austin, Cactus Jack, and Terry Funk defeated Triple H, Road Dogg, and Billy Gunn in a no DQ match. And then finally, at a WWF Monday Night Raw in East Rutherford, New Jersey, The Rock with Triple H and Stephanie McMahon in his corner defeated Rikishi with Steve Austin in his corner, and that allowed Triple H to pick the stipulations for the Three Stages of Hell match, the very first one of which at No Way Out 2001. I remember this match, but I don't quite understand why Rikishi has Steve Austin in his corner, because he just ran over Steve Austin with a car about a year and a half prior to this, so I'm not quite sure how that panned out. Maybe I should go back and watch that on the network. I will be enlightened. Anyway, that's it for this day in Steve Austin history for February 12th. Coming up after the break, we're going to have Kurt Angle on a classic episode of the Steve Austin Show.
All right, listen up. The sports action in the NBA, the NHL, and college basketball is hotter than ever, and each game becomes that much more important. For instance, in the NBA, the Golden State Warriors are dominating. Can they be stopped? You've also got the Bucks and the Raptors at the top of the East, the Denver Nuggets making their claim, and don't forget about the LeBron and the Lakers. Could they make a run? As I've been saying for months, there's only one place here at Podcast One that has all the action you're looking for, betonline.ag. Sign up today for a free account on betonline.ag and use the promo code podcast1 to receive a 50% sign-up bonus. Again, that's betonline.ag for all the details. And while you're there, use promo code podcast1. That's podcast1 to get a 50% sign-up bonus. Don't sit on the sidelines anymore. Get in on the action with betonline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partner of Podcast One Sportsnet. And speaking of bets, you can guarantee that GEICO is a safe bet when it comes to car insurance. Go to GEICO.com and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. That's right. Save hundreds of dollars on car insurance at GEICO.com. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
When my guest today first entered the WWF, there were great expectations as to this young man's potential and what he could accomplish in the business of professional wrestling. I remember thinking, what in the hell is all this hullabaloo about? Well, I was about to find out. I've often gone on record as saying I've never seen anyone adapt to and learn the business of professional wrestling as fast as Kurt Angle. Seemingly overnight, this guy was green as hell. Then about 3 days later, he was a supremely skilled veteran. He's one of my all-time favorite opponents and a guy I had so much comedic chemistry with on a microphone and doing skits backstage to set up angles. I'd like to welcome the one and only 1996 Olympic gold medalist and multi-time champion in any world of professional wrestling, Kurt Angle. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. I'm chilling with my family, and it's an honor to be on your show, man. It's pretty funny.
Man, I tell you what, I was excited to have you on the show. I had so much fun with you. Back in the day, you know, in the days of WWE, and, you know, it's funny because I want to talk about so many things with you, but I remember when you first came into the company, and I think it was you and a couple of other cats, and y'all kind of turned, you know, whatever town we were at. And they were saying, oh, yeah, there's that Olympic gold medalist, blah, 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 blah. You know, when you get into business, it's just another green cat who's got high hopes and aspirations of being a big star someday. And you was put together. You had about a 21-inch neck. And I'm thinking about this guy. I'm thinking, man, this cat's kind of a physical specimen. You know, and I didn't know you were the genetic freak that you would turn out to be. You know, one of those once-in-a-lifetime kind of people that comes along. And I mean that as a compliment. But I remember one time we were at a television tape, and it was Jacksonville, Florida. I was out in a lawn chair out there in the parking lot of the building with all the 18-wheelers parked, and you came by, and we visited for a second. We always were very friendly with each other. And I remember watching your match that night, and it was a very scrappy, hard-fought match. And I was watching you in the explosion and the explosive movements, the things that you were doing, all the chain wrestling. And I said, man, this kid's got a future. This kid has a future. Fast forward all these years, and here you are. Let's talk about your days as a kid growing up in Pennsylvania. You started wrestling when you were 6 years old?
Yes, I did.
Now, how do you start at 6 years of age? I mean, was that organized wrestling? Was it like, you know, Pop Warner football for many of the places?
Well, my brothers were wrestlers, all four of them, and I wasn't very much a fan of wrestling. I was kind of forced into it. My brothers were all really good, and I wasn't that good when I started. As a matter of fact, I didn't really have any kind of success till I got into high school. And so I just kind of wanted to be like my brothers, and the more I did it, and I started training year-round, and the only other sport I did was football. So when it wasn't during football season, I was wrestling all year long, and I just kept getting better and better, and I didn't know I was going to be as good as I was or as good as I was in college and the Olympics. I just wanted to win a state title. And when I did that, you know, next level was college, and I wanted to be an All-American. I didn't know I was going to be a two-time NCAA champion. So at every level, I just kind of took it on and improved. And even in college, I was beating the world-class athletes like the Olympians and well, you know, guys on the world team that, you know, when I was 19 years old, I'm beating these guys. I'm realizing maybe I have that potential to be an Olympic gold medalist. So that's where it all started.
But let's talk about your senior year in high school. I mean, all through when you started in your high school career in wrestling, it was a stellar career by any account. Your senior year in 1987, you were also All-State as a linebacker. So once you were All-State as a linebacker, you had been attracting a lot of attention from a lot of the colleges to continue that endeavor into the collegiate ranks. How did you go about deciding which would it be, wrestling versus football?
You know what? I was recruited heavily for both football and wrestling, and my plans were to go to college to do both. When I got to college, and thank God I went to a Division II school, because there was no way in heck I was going to be able to do Division I for both sports. It would require too much time and effort. I think the only one to ever do it was Dr. Death, Steve Williams.
Right.
And, you know, he only had 2 months to prepare for the NCAA championships, because every year they were in a bowl game. So by January, he had 2 months to get ready for the NCAAs, and he lost to Bruce Baumgartner, four-time Olympic medalist. He lost to him 3-2 in the finals. So Steve was a specimen himself.
He was.
So I didn't. I knew if I went Division I in both sports, there was no way I was going to do it. And I loved both of them, so I went to a Division II school, Clarion. And I redshirted my freshman year for football, and I wrestled. And my first year, I made it to the Nationals. I was seeded in the top six. I was expected to place, and I didn't, and it ate me up. So I decided to quit football and put my effort into wrestling.
Well, check it out, man. You're one of those, as I say, you know, once-in-a-generation type athletes. But going back to the football thing, because I'm such a football fan, as I am amateur wrestling and obviously a pro wrestling fan, I got to think of your statistics. You're about 6 foot. How much did you weigh when you graduated high school?
I was about 230.
230?
Yeah.
Okay, so what kind of 40 time were you cutting?
4.6.
Pretty damn good speed for a white boy. But check it out. Here you go, man. 6'0", 230, fire plug of a guy. Running at 4.6 40, that's very respectable athletic ability. But what kind of football player were you? Were you a heavy-duty hitter? Were you a maniac? Because, I mean, your dogged determination, you know, in the amateur circles speaks for itself. But how were you? What type of football player were you on the gridiron?
Well, I played in, the biggest league, the Quad A division in Pennsylvania, and nobody in Quad A went both ways. In other words, offense and defense.
Mm-hmm.
I was the only player on my team to do that. I never left the field. I was a fullback and I was a middle linebacker, so I stayed in the game the whole time. And yeah, my biggest attribute was how hard I hit. And I was always around the ball. I led the team in interceptions, fumble recoveries, tackles. I had a few 100-yard games and running as a fullback, but I was more of a blocking back. But I was always around the ball, and whether it was luck or whatever it was, it was like a magnet. I was always where the ball always was. And
nose for the football. Always
gotta
be right. You kind of had a nose for the football. You've always got to be around that football to make something happen.
Yeah. And I could always feel which way the ball was going. I read the offenses extremely well. I called the plays in defense. So I was a captain of the defensive team. I was just as good of a football player as I was a wrestler, but I liked being a wrestler because I was the only one on the mat. It wasn't a team sport. It was individual.
Did you like that, just relying on yourself? I mean, yeah, football is a great game, and football is my favorite sport. But speaking of wrestling, and like when I was in high school, I focused on throwing the discus and track because I could just be out there by myself, you know, coaching myself, so to speak, and just, you know, kind of being a loner. But it all depended on me. The weight was on my shoulders. Was it like you with the wrestling?
Yeah, a lot like that. I wanted the credit. I wanted to go out there and rely on myself. I didn't want to have to rely on other people for me to win. And wrestling was my avenue. And I never thought I would be that good at an individual sport. I always thought that I would be a team player because when I was a kid, I didn't like wrestling and I liked playing on teams and, you know, playing with my friends. And,
yeah.
But something changed inside of me in middle school, and the attention drew to me. And, you know, I started seeing that everybody saw the potential in me, and, you know, winning a state national title in high school, it was a great feeling. And I could tell you, there's nothing fun about wrestling until you get your hand raised. And
the work that goes into it. Hey, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about. Back in the day, I can't remember if it was a special that someone did on you or was it WWE, but it showed some of your training logs, some footage of you training, and the brutality, the conditioning that you put yourself through, the sacrifices that you made were just unbelievable. I mean, I really couldn't fathom doing this on a daily basis like you did. Tell me a little bit about the conditioning, because, you know, in the professional wrestling ring, when you get gassed, when you get blown up, that's what we call it, getting blown up. And you know better than anybody, you know, at that level of elite athletics, wrestling, amateur wrestling, you have to be in tremendous shape, because if you're sucking wind, you're not thinking about winning, you're thinking about surviving.
Exactly. You're exactly right, Steve, and that's what I did. What my training consisted of was, I call it exhaust training. I would train till I was exhausted, and that's when the training began. And in other words, I'll give you a quick, I never took a day off. I went every day. I had one half day a month, and the other 29 days were full days. So I trained 10 hours a day. In the morning, I would run 6 miles, and then I would do 40 hill sprints, 200-yard hill sprints. 20 of them would be with my partner on my back, and the other 20 would be me just running up a hill. I would jog back down. Then I would get on the Aerodyne for an hour. I'd do that, sprint work, 1 minute fast, 1 minute easy, 1 minute fast, 1 minute easy. Then I jump rope for 30 minutes, and then I get in the sauna for a half hour. So it usually took me about 2.5 hours to do. Then I eat lunch, and then an hour later, I would go wrestle. And that would consist of technique, live wrestling, and more conditioning. And that would take me about 3 hours. And then the evening was the hardest, because that's when I did my heavyweight training and plyometrics. And I would finish it off with conditioning with sprint work. It was every day. It was constant pounding. I knew that if I did it, that I would tire out my opponents, and that's how I won. I wasn't the best technician. I wasn't the biggest or the fastest or the strongest or even the smartest, but I knew if I got the guy tired, that he would be sucking wind, he would be blown up, and he would be worried about surviving, and that's when I'd be able to attack and score on him and win, and that's what happened. That's how I won the Olympic gold medal.
And that's exactly what my next question was going to be. I mean, I know when you go into a match, you're focused on winning, but I was just wondering what your strategy was. So, and just what you said, it was just hanging in there, tiring that guy out, and then taking advantage of that situation and pinning him or outpointing him.
Yeah, and that's what I did. I tired him out, and a lot of it had to do with, when I wasn't wrestling, I was watching tape. I was scouting my opponent, seeing what their strengths were, their weaknesses. It was a job for me. I mean, I spent probably 15 hours a day total with everything that I did. It consisted of it. I lived it. I breathed it. For 12 years, that's all I did. I didn't have a job, and my job was wrestling. And, thank God it worked out extremely well for me. I started in high school, went through college, went 4 more years for the Olympics, and, I won every title you could win. I'm one of only 4 Americans to win the Grand Slam, which is the Junior Nationals, the NCAAs, the World Championships, and the Olympics. And, I'm going to go down in history as one of the greatest of all time. So, it makes me proud that I did that. And I look back, and I was 26 years old when I retired from amateur wrestling. I was just a baby. I still had a lot more room for improvement, but I was so burned out from the training and the stress level of winning a world title and then winning the gold medal the next year, that doesn't happen very often. You can't win a world title and win the gold medal back to back. Not many people have ever done that. So there was a lot of stress on me, and I knew that after 96, I was done. And that's when WWE contacted me.
I want to talk about WWE contacting you, because I think you first turned down their offer. But before we do that, I did want to focus a little bit on the 1996 Summer Olympic Games in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, I've heard the story many different ways, but I want to hear it straight from the horse's mouth. What kind of neck issues were you dealing with as you headed into the Olympics that year?
Well, unfortunately, I got thrown on my head at the U.S. Open, which was 2.5 months before the Olympics. It was one of the qualifiers to make it to the Olympic trials. And you had to win the U.S. Open in order to get a bye to the finals of the Olympic trials. In the semifinals, a guy locked me up and threw me on my head, and I tried to put my arm up so I wouldn't land on my back, because if you go from your feet to your back, it's a, it's a 5-point move, and it's pretty hard to catch up and score those 5 points to tie it up. Well, I went to put my hand out. I couldn't, so I stuck my head up, and I landed right on my head, and I heard this cracking and crunching sound on my neck, and I'm sure you're familiar with it.
Yeah.
But right then, I knew something was wrong, and I got up, and my left arm was numb, and I was down by 5 points. So I gave up the points, and so I'm in the semis. I kept wrestling. I fired back. I scored 5 points, and at the last second, I scored another takedown. I won 6-5. And then 8 hours later, I had to wrestle in the finals, and I was thinking about backing out because of my neck, and I didn't know it was broken at the time. I broke 4 vertebrae, and 3 discs were sticking directly into my spinal cord.
Jesus.
And so they were trying to do, you know, that stuff where they stick your pins in your neck and your head and whatever. I can't remember what it's called. But they were trying that, you know, anything they could to loosen my neck up. Well, I wrestled 8 hours later. In extreme pain. I won double overtime, 0-0 referee's decision against a great wrestler named Kerry McCoy, who was a 2-time Olympian, the next 2 Olympics after me. So I then went to the Olympic trials with my neck broken the next month. I had to win 2 out of 3 matches, and the wrestler, Dan Chade, who made it to the finals against me, all he did was went after my neck. And that was probably the biggest mistake he made, because every time he reached out for my neck, I'd go down to his legs. So I won fairly easily, and because I was training, my neck never healed. So during these matches, even the Olympics, I had to hire a doctor to travel with me. And what he would do, since my neck was broken and I had those discs sticking in my spinal cord, we weren't allowed to use cortisone because it was a steroid.
Right.
And it's illegal in the Olympics. So he was sticking me in my neck with 12 different shots of Novocaine to numb my neck up so I couldn't feel it.
That sounds fun.
So basically, I didn't train for the whole last month and a half. I hardly trained at all. I just had to make it there and wrestle and basically numb my neck so I couldn't feel it. And I was really surprised at the results, you know, of winning the Olympic trials and winning the Olympic gold medal with my neck broken and knowing that I couldn't train the way I wanted to.
Well, you win the gold medal. You're representing the greatest country in the world, the United States of America. Hey, what goes through your mind when you accomplish something like that after all the work you've put in?
I'll tell you real quick. Even, you know, having the neck and everything, also my coach got murdered that year, Dave Schultz, and they're doing a movie called Foxcatcher this year on it. He was a big part of my training, and losing him was also a back step for me. But, you know, obviously the neck was the biggest thing. But winning the gold medal, and a lot of athletes will tell you this, and I just talked to a guy named Jake Varner, who was a gold medalist at the last Olympics in my weight class. The thing is, when you win, obviously, you have an overwhelming feeling of happiness, and you're elated. But I think more than anything, it's a sense of relief. Finally, over. It's done. You did it.
You didn't fail.
I felt that more than anything.
Right. You didn't fail. I mean, to me, winning a gold, silver, bronze is a big deal. But if you have a chance to win the gold, you don't want the silver or the bronze. You want the gold. So winning not only is there the elation, but, the fact that you did not fail.
Yeah, you know what? I wouldn't have been happy with anything less than the gold. If I would have won the silver, I knew that I'd go back another 4 years and try for the gold again. So
I mean, silver, but silver second place, and second place sucks in competitive athletics.
It does.
I mean, you don't get
it
in
does.
Anything competitive to say, God dang it, I'm shooting my ass off here. I'm trying to be number two. It's all about being number one. Am I right?
You're exactly right, Steve. And I'll tell you this personally. I've taken second before, and second does suck. But I'll tell you this. I learned more from taking second than anything I've ever done winning. You know, my junior year, I beat a guy 11-1. His name was John Llewellyn. And I blew my knee out right before the Nationals. And he ended up beating me 6-5 in the finals, and that ate me alive for the rest of my career. And I wrestled him numerous times after that and beat him, but
That one loss right there killed me. That's the way it goes.
I knew I hated losing from him.
Hey, you know what? Before we jump into a little bit of pro wrestling, and everybody knows that you won a gold medal, but probably so many more people are familiar with your career inside a 20 by 20 ring, the business of professional wrestling, a business that you and I both love. But let's talk about wrestling in the Olympics. What's going on there? Are we going to have? Are they going to take the Are they going to take wrestling out of the Olympics? I've seen you all over the place in TNA, providing your support. What's the story?
TNA's been great in supporting Save Olympic Wrestling, but what happened was the IOC had a meeting, and wrestling was supposed to be there to represent our sport. But as the wrestling FILA, the World Governing Body of Wrestling, they didn't show up because they didn't think that anybody was ever going to drop wrestling. It's the world's oldest and greatest sport. And, the Olympics started with wrestling. So we've been a little bit arrogant about our sport and how it's been growing and the success it's had. And so we just never expected anything like that. So there were a lot of sports thrown on the table to be dropped, like the pentathlon, badminton, many other sports, and their representatives were there. And whether they politicked back in or they paid a bunch of money to stay in, they did one or the other. And when wrestling got thrown on the table, nobody was there. And they said, okay, we're going to drop wrestling. And it was a wake-up call for amateur wrestling because, like I said, we always treated, you know, our sport like we were above everybody else. Well, we're not. Because when it comes down to it, you know, it's about money. The Olympics is about money.
Right.
Business. You know, they want to make money. They want ratings. They want, you know, all these different things that consist of making money. And if wrestling doesn't want to abide by the IFC's rules, they're going to drop it. It'd be the same thing with any other sport. And we were the ones that got taken down. So we had this campaign, Save Olympic Wrestling. And on May 29th, we had a meeting with the IOC. And thank God we were one of the three sports to be considered to be taken back in. So in September, I would believe that what is going to happen is wrestling got thrown on the table. It got dropped in February. Wrestling will get voted back in September, so the whole 9 months is going to be for nothing. But at least wrestling has learned a valuable lesson from this, that we can't take anything for granted anymore. We need to change our rules. We need to keep them simple so people understand what we're doing. Wrestling was changing rules every 4 years, and the fans that were watching were saying, how'd that guy score a point? I don't understand. You know, a guy would back out of bounds and nobody would get taken down, and another guy would get a point and nobody understood because we are always changing the rules.
Right.
And, you know, I think we need to keep it relatively simple. A takedown's 1 point. If you turn a guy, it's two. If you pin a guy, the match is over. You know, wrestling went from being in periods, three different periods, to one period, and now it's three rounds. You actually wrestle in rounds now. So it keeps evolving, and every time you watch the Olympics, it's changed. And it's hard for the viewers at home to say, wait a minute, I watched last Olympics and it wasn't like this, and it's too hard for me to understand. So what we need to do is we need to go back. We need to keep the rules the same all the time and keep them relatively simple for the audience to understand.
Keep it simple.
Exactly. And, you know, wrestling is one of the it's number four as far as popularity, how many people are involved in wrestling in the United States. That's high on the list. And it continues to grow. Right now, at this point, we're at its highest peak since 1980. And it has a lot to do with, obviously, what you and I have done. Pro wrestling, it has a lot to do with MMA. Has a lot to do with colleges, thank God, that are picking up wrestling again. Due to Title IX in 1990, you know, wrestling was getting dropped left and right. These programs, they equal the sports with men and women. Well, now colleges are picking it back up again. So now we're getting momentum, so we just got to keep running with it. But we have the best structure in the world for wrestling. United States, you know, we have miniature wrestling, we have junior high wrestling, we have high school wrestling, college wrestling, and then we have the Olympics. If you look at any other sport, any other contact sport, or gymnastics, well, not gymnastics, but taekwondo or karate or any of those sports, you can't do that in school for free. You got to go to a club and pay someone to train you. Well, wrestling is such a, you know, it's an easy sport to get involved in. Go to your high school or your junior high, get involved in wrestling, learn from the coach, you know, and just keep taking the next level up, high school, college, Olympic level. So our structure is amazing here, and it's amazing that we don't dominate as much as we should in the Olympics. But as you know, Steve, our sport and wrestling here in the United States is different than the Olympic style wrestling. We have our own style of wrestling, just like we have our own football. You know, football right. over in Europe is soccer. So, you know, we have different roles, and so we have to adapt to that after college and to the Olympic style, and it's hard to do, but, you know, what are you going to do? You know, the United States of America, we always want our own type of sport.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
It's time to get in shape with Ben Greenfield Fitness on Podcast One. Tune into the latest health, fitness, and multi-sport research, non-run-of-the-mill interviews with exercise and medicine professionals, and new cutting-edge content from the top personal trainer and wellness coach in the nation.
You've heard me talk about using infrared light and red light therapy, guys, on your skin, cellulite. I was going to say ladies, but guys have cellulite too.
Download Ben Greenfield Fitness every Wednesday on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
Kurt, I was doing a little bit of reading online, and I found out this little thing here, and let me know if this is what really happened or not. It was an ECW show, which Shane Douglas invited you to, and you left the building when Raven crucified Sandman by attaching him to a cross with barbed wire. Did that really happen? Were you offended? What's the story?
Well, I went to the show, and what I was told before I even went from Shane Douglas was that this new wrestling promotion was trying to be more like amateur wrestling.
And ECW?
Yeah. And he said that he would love for me to come, and they would pay me a good bit of money to go, and I would commentate a match that Taz had against Guido. So I showed up at the show, and I did the match, and the next match happened to be Raven and Sandman, and I'm watching Raven. He pulls a crucifix out from underneath the ring, puts it up, and basically crucifies Sandman, and Sandman's son's behind him with his arms up like the sign of a cross, and he's shaking his head like, yes. And everybody in the crowd was shocked. I mean, nobody really, I think there were a lot more people offended. And I looked at Paul Heyman, and I said, did you know about this? He goes, no, Kurt, I had no idea what was going to happen.
Meanwhile, you believed him, right?
Yeah, I didn't believe him. And I said, well, give me my effing money right now, and if you put me on the same show that this is on, you're going to hear from my attorney. And he said, I promise you, Kurt, it won't be on the show. And I left the building. I didn't stay to the end of the show. I was offended. I didn't like it. I know there have been other stints, even in WWF, way back with, I believe it was with Undertaker, where they did something identical, but it wasn't exactly like this. This was really offensive, and I couldn't stay any longer. It made me sick to my stomach, so I left, and I never looked back again. But that was actually after I was approached by Vince McMahon in WWF.
But I read that you turned down the initial offer presented to you by WWF. Were you too good to be a pro wrestler? What was your attitude? Hey, I want to know.
I didn't turn it down. Okay, first of all, when I was approached, Vince McMahon flew me up. I sat down with him. And me knowing nothing about the business, I told Vince, he offered me a contract. It was a 10-year deal, and it was a lot of money. And I didn't make any money as an amateur wrestler, so here was this multi-million dollar deal, thank God. And I said, you know what, there's one thing, though, I need to tell you, Vince, or Mr. McMahon, I can't lose.
You can't lose in pro wrestling. You are one crazy bastard. Keep going.
So Vince, I could tell he wanted to bust out laughing, but he was trying to keep his face straight. And I didn't know anything about it. I believe Bruce Pritchard was in the room as well. And he said, well, take the contract home. Think about it, but I can't promise you you're going to win every match. And I took the contract home, and I took it to my agent, Ralph Sinders, who happens to be a very successful NFL agent. He's also Ben Roethlisberger's agent. And at the time, he took the contract from me, and he threw it in the garbage. He said, you're not doing this crap. And I literally never looked back. I went and I did a stint as a sportscaster for a year and did a lot of motivational speaking, and I did a lot of clinics and camps for wrestling. And one night in late 98, I turned on Roz Wharf, and I saw a character named Stone Cold Steve Austin. And the stuff that you guys were doing, you're actually, Steve, I'm not doing this to put you over, but you're actually the reason I started. And it wasn't just you, but I mean, at the time you were so hot, and you know, everybody, you know, it was just this Stone Cold Steve Austin craze thing going on, and I'm watching you wrestle, and wow, this guy's actually a really great athlete, and on the mic, he's entertaining and funny and intense, and I said, you know what, it'd be really cool if I, you know, if I could do that. And I remember at the time, you guys had so many different, you know, wrestlers, great wrestlers like Triple H and The Rock and Undertaker and Kane, a lot of great characters, even guys like Val Venus and Bob Holly. I mean, everybody was over, and it was like, it was the Attitude Era. And I looked at my girlfriend at the time, you know what, I think I'm going to call WWE and WWF at the time, and I'm going to see if that contract still stands. And I called, and Vince McMahon said, Jim Ross. I talked to him, and I asked if the contract would still go as planned. He said no. He said, at this point, you're going to have to come up and try out.
Yeah.
And I said, I'll come up and try out. And Steve, when I went up the first day, my manager was there. I took 3 bumps in the ring, and I can tell everybody listening, it was the hardest thing I ever did. Every bump killed me. I looked at my manager, and I said, I don't think I can do this. And I always tell everybody, I was an amateur wrestler, Olympic gold medalist, one of the toughest sports in the world. I was a great football player, one of the toughest sports in the world. I got in that wrestling ring, and after 3 bumps, I literally said, these pro wrestlers are either crazy or they're the baddest MFers in the world. And that doesn't mean they can kick your ass, but they can take a beating more than any individual in this whole world.
There's nothing like slamming into that mat, and it's just a total come to Jesus meeting with reality. Whatever you think about that business, it all changes as soon as you hit that mat, mister, and you either learn to love bumping or you kind of just don't really get in the business, because it just goes part and parcel with the business. When I broke in Chris Adams' school, I mean, basically the school was learning how to take a bump. I barely learned how to wrestle at all. They covered the basics, but it was all about slapping that mat, a karate-type fall, protect your back. Because as you know, if you want to take that flat back landing, when you start landing in stages and whip the rest of your body down, that's when everything gets discombobulated, and that's when the injuries start piling up. So you go in, you do your tryout, you take those 3 bumps, you think, oh, holy shit, what have I gotten myself into? What was your mindset then?
I was going to quit, and my manager brought me in.
You hadn't even started yet.
I'm telling you, it was the hardest thing I ever did in my life, and I stayed. And within 4 days, I had my first match, and I didn't know what I was doing. It was against Tom Pritchard, and he called the whole thing, and I just followed him. And it came to me relatively easy, even though I look back, and it was hard as heck, because here I was, and I will admit to everyone that I didn't know what I was doing when I started on TV. When I started on TV, and I mean, I worked my way up the ranks faster than anyone that I've ever seen. I was wrestling you and The Rock within my first year, and I didn't know a thing about wrestling.
I can vouch for you. You didn't know a thing. No, I'm kidding you. I'm kidding you. When you broke into business, I, on record, at any interview I've ever done, I say on the record, no one has ever picked up the business of professional wrestling as fast as Kurt Angle. I mean, it was absolutely incredible how you were able to come in, adapt. I mean, obviously, your wrestling background helps with all of the wrestling, but amateur wrestling and pro wrestling, and you throw in the psychology, and then the work aspect, and you've got to lose that mark aspect from when you first came into that contract and said, I'm not going to lose. There's just so much that goes into it, but Jesus, I mean, you were like a duck to water.
Yeah, but you know what? The thing I did when I started is I watched the top guys. I watched you. I watched Triple H. I watched The Rock. I watched Undertaker. I watched whether it had to do with promos or it had to do with wrestling. With you, it was both, because people don't know this, because you're so underrated as a wrestler because your character was so damn strong that people don't know how good you were. You were in the ring. You were the best improviser I've ever wrestled. That means we didn't have to plan anything backstage. You could lead me through a match, and I didn't have to think about anything because all I had to do was listen to you. I can't say that about every wrestler. I think Triple H was pretty good at it. Taker was pretty good at it. But you were the best. There were guys that needed to call everything back in the back, and I'm not going to say that they were. But with you, it was so easy because all I had to do was go out there and listen to you. And you made me look good, so everybody thought that I was better than I really was. But I did catch on. But from listening to you and working with you and watching you, and I did the same thing in amateur wrestling. I studied tapes. I kept watching you and watching the top guys and studying you and seeing what to do, not only from a wrestling aspect, but from an entertaining aspect. And it got a lot easier when I turned my instincts off from amateur wrestling and I started learning something new, which was the art of pro wrestling. The psychology is so hard. Everybody thinks you just go out there and do a bunch of stunts. If that's what you do, you're never going to get over.
How long did it take you to have a full grasp of psychology?
Right after I got done working with you, which meant that I was 2 years in the business, I became a ring general. And what I mean by that
But from a babyface standpoint, what about from a heel psychology, babyface psychology, and then putting the whole picture together?
I would say, yeah. I mean, I was a heel my first year. Second year, I had to run with you as a babyface. And then I'd say by my third year, after 2 years, I was working with the Jerichos and the Benoits and the Eddie Guerreros and the those guys, and I was
badass workers.
Yeah. But the great thing about it was most of the time I was structuring the matches,
right.
And it was because I was learning from the best guys, and that's what I always try to tell these younger wrestlers is study the top guys. That's the way to get over. See how they work, because that's what I did, and I knew that if I could do what you guys did, and I knew that when Stone Cold Steve Austin was watching me wrestle, he would say, I want to work with that guy. So I had to be on my A game to know that Steve Austin would tell Vince McMahon, I want to work with him next. And I remember one night I had a cage match with Chris Benoit where you were commentating.
Yep.
And I watched the match over, and I saw you in awe because you were watching us do the most stupid stunts, most idiotic crap, in the main event at Raw in a cage where we were Germaning each other off the top rope, flipping off the top of the cage, and you were just sitting there speechless. And I thought to myself, oh, man, Austin's not going to want to work with me because he thinks I'm nuts.
Well, you know what? It was interesting because I watched that match this morning on YouTube before I came up to talk to you, and I remember that night, and what you're saying is true. I mean, yeah, halftime I was being stone cold, and I was commentating, but I was blown away by what I was seeing, and you guys stole the show. I mean, that match had an impact for several months. I mean, anytime someone stepped into a cage right after that, they were expected to try to top the effort that you and Benoit put forth, and that wasn't going to happen. I mean, the moonsault off the top, the diving headbutt off the top, the suplexes off the top rope, the belly to backs. I mean, just the whole thing from top to bottom. And it was in a crash and burn fashion, but laid out in strong psychology. Would I have worked that match? No, probably not. We would have done many of the same things, but many different things. But no, I thought you guys told a wonderful story that night, and it was a bust-ass, badass match.
Well, I appreciate it, but at the same time, when I watched it back, I said, oh, man, he's not going to work with me. And this is when Benoit was just starting to get up to the main event level. And, I felt like I took a step back. And we put it together, right? But I think it was so crazy that, when you have the top guy ever in the business watching and saying, shit, I don't want to work with these guys. It's kind of like all that effort that we did out there was for nothing. And that's why when I saw the look on your face, I'm like, I got really down on myself, like, oh, man, why did I do that? And I felt like I screwed up.
Well, you know, from a standpoint of a guy like me watching that, and maybe even I can't speak for Undertaker, but a guy like him or me would watch this and think, wow, look what this guy is capable of. Look at what this guy is willing to do. If you can just change his, you know, head around a little bit or do the things you want to do in the context that you want to do. Hey, but also to see that you're very safe, you're very sound, you take care of people, then that's the kind of guys you want to work with. And also, when you watch a guy, you know, putting it all on the line like that on a Monday Night Raw, and you think, look at the effort. This son of a bitch wants to be on top, and he's making it known. And with that being said, I'm not saying for everybody to go out there, these young cats who are trying to come up, to go jump off a bunch of really big, tall cages and stuff. It's part of the dues-paying process. But, you know, you made a statement with that match. But now I want to ask you, look at that match now and putting yourself in the shoes, the wrestling boots that you're still wearing, would you go out and perform that same kind of match? Or are you at that space right now where you think, okay, you got to work. You still got to work hard, but you got to work smarter, not harder.
That's me now. I'm working smarter, not harder. And if I watch that match, Steve, and I'm in the position now where I choose who I want to work with.
Right.
And I watch you know, when I was in WWF and you went to the shows, you went to every freaking show and you were headlining, main event in every show, but you watched every match. And I learned from you. So when I'm at my house shows, I watch every match. And I look and I study everybody and I get ideas from it. And I watch the guys, see how talented they are. But I look to see who's the next guy I can work with. And that's what I'm trying to envision in my mind. Is this guy ready for Kurt Angle? So, you know, I saw you doing and I saw you always watching the matches. So I pull a chair off behind that apron or behind the you know, whatever it is, the curtain. And I watch every match and I study every guy that goes out there to see who's ready to work with Kurt Angle and who's not.
You know, that was one of the things when I broke into business. I went out and had a match in Tennessee. It was at a spot show. I thought I did pretty good. I came back to the dressing room. Dutch Mantel cussed me for 5 minutes, then instructed me. It was constructive criticism. And I love this because the guy was so honest with me to call me aside and give me his opinion and to care. And he had to care because he was booking the territory and it was money on the line. But from that match forward, he told me every single night, he goes, you get a steel chair, you sit it in front of that door and you watch all these matches. He said, that's the only way you're going to learn this stuff. And that's why I did what I did because of Dutch. But also, you know, once you've learned a shit pile of stuff, you go out there and you watch those matches because if you're in the main event, I might be thinking, you know what? I might work an arm tonight, might work his neck. But then all of a sudden you go out there, everybody's working an arm. And then there's guys in the dressing room playing video games because they're too lazy to go out and watch the matches. They go out, work the arm, but because they weren't paying attention. Well, I'm in that main event. I'm going to switch up, go to a lower back, a leg, something. But I ain't got my head in my ass. So my point is to any of you guys up and coming, get your ass out there. In any building you go to, there is a vantage point where you can watch these matches. And if you have the wherewithal or the capabilities, buy you a little shitty video camera like Diamond Dallas Page did back in the day and videotape your matches. We used to do that with Dallas, and it would irk me to no end to check into a hotel after traveling a couple of hundred miles and have to critique his match. But that's why the guy got as good as he did and found the success, because he gave a crap and was trying to, you know, speed up the process. I want to talk to you a little bit about, because right now you had such a body of work in WWE, about a 7-year run, give or take. And now you've been in TNA for give or take seven or so years, correct?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe there's a little bit of a political balance that we want to maintain there. But before you left WWE, you had a neck injury. What exactly was that neck injury? Because when Dr. Joe went in and did your procedure, I thought that your neck was kind of in a little bit of the same state that mine was, and you took a little bit different method to get that thing fixed. What was the initial damage? What was the diagnosis?
Well, I had a lot of the same symptoms you had. And what happened was I broke my neck again, three vertebrae, two of my discs slipped to the side and blocked the nerves in my left arm. So I couldn't raise my left arm, and it started to atrophy, and So I went and saw your doctor. I believe it was Youngblood.
Yeah.
I went down there and, you know, he said, listen, you know, it looks like we're going to have to fuse. I'd like to fuse four, but if I fuse four, you're going to have to retire.
Mm. So, and Youngblood was a pretty conservative doctor. I can't believe that he wanted to do a four-level fusion. So go ahead.
The thing is, he said, listen, you got the third worst neck I've ever seen. And I said, well, who's the first? He said, Austin.
That's a dubious distinction.
Who's second? And I believe he said, I forget, it was another athlete, but he said, mine was the third worst. Yours was the worst. And he said, listen, we're going to have to do fusion. And, you know, basically sent me home. And I had a doctor contact me here in Pittsburgh. And he said, listen, I have a different procedure. And I thought he was some crazy chiropractor. So I was getting ready to go down to Youngblood and get the fusion. And my father-in-law at the time told me, you need to see this doctor because he does have a new method and you're only going to be out a month. And I said, that's crazy because everybody's been out a year with the fusion. So I went and saw him. And he told me he could fix it, and he did. And I was back within 5 or 6 weeks, and I was wrestling strong again. And what do you know, 6 months later, Brock Lesnar hits me with the hardest chair shot right on top of my head.
Mm.
Breaks three vertebrae again, and two more discs slide to the left again. Now I'm screwed again. I got to have the surgery over again. And so I had the surgery again, and they had to take out a little bit more of my disc, two of them. So basically what they did is they did orthoscopic surgery of my neck like you do in a knee. You know, when you have a cartilage sticking out and it's clicking, they cut part of that cartilage out, and then your knee's fine. Well, in my neck, I'm missing a little bit more of my disc than anybody else, but I didn't have to have fusion. And I believe I made the right decision, even though, Steve, you did what you did. I believe I made the right decision because right now, thank God, I haven't had a neck symptom in 8 years. But I did have a spin of them, and I did break my neck again a fourth time, three times in WWE, where I broke four vertebrae again the following year. And it had a lot to do with the crazy stuff I did. It had a lot to do with, you know, working 270, 280 days a year and just not letting my body heal. And I, you know, I just kept breaking down. And so I felt like at the time I needed to, you know, back out and regroup. And I didn't really know I was going to end up in TNA. But, you know, I did ask Vince McMahon for a release, and Vince was very gracious. I had 5.5 years left in my contract. He could have stuck me to it.
Right.
But he said, listen, I'll let you go, man. If that's what you really want, you go ahead and do it. You know, get your bearings together. Come on back in 6 months, and we'll give you the same deal. And I had the same deal as you had, Steve. So I was, you know, I was very blessed with, you know, having what I did. I didn't make the money you did, but, I mean, you know, I had the same guarantee. So, you know, Vince gave me that grace period, and I decide, you know what, I'm going to go with a slower schedule, and because at the time, I knew that Vince would probably not let me go part time. I knew that he would not let me do just the TVs and pay per views.
Right.
And I figured, you know what, I think TNA might be the better option right now. And I went down there, and they have pretty much taken good care of me. So I've been happy with that, you know. But do I miss some of the things? Yeah, I miss the times I had with Stone Cold Steve Austin and, you know, you're the guy, the one guy I looked up to the most. I miss the storyline with Triple H and Stephanie. I miss a lot of the funny moments. You know, I used to go to TVs back then, and I couldn't wait. I was like a kid in a candy store. I couldn't wait to see what we were going to do next. It was the most entertaining era of all time. And, you know, you were running the charge at the time, and, you know, you helped get me over, and, you know, and then I started kind of running the charge there for a while, and that's when you kind of bowed out. I think you hurt your back, right?
Yeah, it was just kind of a culmination of things. Oh, well, you know, going back to the, you know, when I broke the vertebrates in my back, and that's when you and me kind of started going into the comedy stuff. That's when I bowed out for a little bit. But, you know, with talking about your neck, you got the procedure done by Joe. You're pain and problem free in the neck right now, correct?
Yeah.
What about the rest of your carcass? Let's take inventory on the rest of your body. Arms, shoulders, legs, knees. How you feeling otherwise?
Right now, I haven't been this healthy since in 8 years. what I did, and I was getting injured a lot this past year. Well, I did something really stupid a year and a half ago. I started training for the Olympics again, and my body at 43 was just breaking down. I was getting injured every month and a half. Knee injury, hamstring tear, groin tear. You know, I had dislocated my shoulder, and I'm like, you know, it just got to the point where I couldn't, you know, I just kept getting hurt. And then I decided I wasn't going to do it, so I backed out, and I started gaining weight and trying to get real big again. And that didn't help me because the bigger I got, the more injuries I got. My knees started hurting. And yes. I'm a runner, and my doctors tell me, you can't run anymore. I said, wait a minute, I run 5 miles a day. You're telling me I can't run? He said, no, your knees are too bad. So I was weighing about 255.
Jesus Christ.
I was too big. And now I'm 230, and my knees are fine, and I'm running again, and I'm feeling better. And so basically, it was a weight gain. I was just, my body at 44, I can't carry 255 and be healthy.
But when the doctor was saying you got bad knees, what was wrong with your knees? Just the extra weight on them? You got some ligament tears,
yeah.
Some spacing problems, cartilage?
Well, Steve, same as you. I've had major injuries with my knees, ligament damage, cartilage damage. I've had surgery twice on both knees, but I've always worked through it, and I've always been active, and I've always run. And I was always told by my doctor, as long as you train your legs, you won't have problems. But when you quit, you're gonna have knee problems. And what I did the last 3 years is I quit training my legs. I wasn't doing squats or leg presses anymore. I was gaining weight, getting bigger with my upper body. My legs were staying smaller, and my glutes and everything. And what happened was, you know, because I wasn't training my lower half of my body, and I was only training my upper half, and I was gaining a bunch of weight. And it took a toll on my knees. And, you know, and once I started retraining my legs again, the pain went away. But I was having some serious arthritis, a lot of arthritis effects on my knees last year where I couldn't get out of bed and walk. And I figured, oh, man, I'm getting ready to retire. There's no way I'm going to be able to keep going. But what I figured out was all I had to do was lose that 25 extra pounds that I was keeping on. And now here I am. I'm running 5 miles a day again. I'm doing heavy legs. As long as I train my legs, my knees are going to be fine. Once I stop, that's when my knees are going to get all shaky and decrepit. And that's when my career's going to turn south.
Are you trying any of the glucosamine-type products for joints?
Every day.
Do you believe in that? Yeah. I take mine sporadically, but I'm just bad about taking pills. So do you swear by it?
I started making a habit out of it.
Is it a real deal?
You know what? I don't know, Steve. I wish I could say yes. I take the fish oil and I take the glucosamine. I don't know, but it's worth taking that chance. I mean, you know, you got to do what you got to do to make it in this business. And if it does help, or if it makes a mental advantage for me and makes me think I'm healthier, then, you know, thank God it's working. So right now I'm 100% healthy. No matter where I go, if I'm, you know, I got a year and a half left in TNA, and I'm going to be loyal to this company for that year and a half. When that contract's up, whether I stay or I go, I want to make sure I'm 100% healthy, because I'm not ready to retire yet.
Okay, with that being said, Kurt, before we end this conversation, how much time do you have left inside that squared circle?
I'm going to guess probably, I would say 4 years.
Another 4 years. Going at the pace you're going, still taking the bumps you're taking? I mean, you're still working a very physical work style. I've been watching some of the stuff, you and AJ and all the aces of eights. I mean, you're still a bumping machine. You're taking a lot of punishment. You've got 4 years left in you.
Yeah, I got 4 years left in me. I wouldn't have said that a year ago, but I feel good now. And I'm working smarter, Steve. When I do take bumps, I'm taking them. Obviously, I do it right, thank God. But I'm very selective about what I do. I'm not doing the crazy ass stuff I was doing 5 years ago and 10 years ago. But I still do enough that people, you know, I'll tell you what. I had a compliment last TV. I was wrestling and I was insulted by it more than I took the compliment of it. But, you know, I got up on the top rope and I did a drop kick and I doubled down and the fans got up and said, "You still got it." And I'm like, "Wait a minute. Hold on a second. I'm not that old yet."
Did they think you had lost it?
Yeah, exactly. But when did I lose it? Because, well, you know, I'm not sure when that happened, but, you know, I didn't know whether to take it as a compliment or as an insult. But,
right.
You know, that's what they were cheering. But, yeah, I mean, I am selective about what I do, but if it's a pay-per-view or if it's a very important main event TV, I'm gonna go on all four cylinders.
You gotta pick your spots. Right.
Here's a relationship tip for all you guys. Valentine's Day is this Thursday. If you haven't picked out the surprise for that special person in your life, you have just 2 days to do so. Thankfully, for all my listeners, we have a great deal on the biggest and brightest roses, only found at 1-800-Flowers.com. 1-800-Flowers is going to hook you up with amazing deals on Valentine's rose bouquets, arrangements, and more, starting at just $29.99. As a matter of fact, they've got 18 romantic red roses for just $29.99. A hell of a deal. Roses from 1-800-Flowers are picked at their peak and shipped overnight to ensure freshness. All you have to do is pick your delivery date and let 1-800-Flowers handle the rest. There are so many unbelievable deals from 1-800-Flowers, but you have to hurry. To order Valentine's Day bouquets and arrangements such as 18 romantic red roses for just $29.99, go to 1-800-Flowers.com. Click the radio icon and enter code Austin. Be a damn hero this Valentine's Day. Order and save today at 1-800-Flowers.com, code Austin. All right, I'm giving Sean a go-home cue, so let's wrap it up for this week. Make sure you check out podcast1.com and subscribe to The Steve Austin Show so you don't miss any of these classic episodes. Before I ride off in the sunset, I do want to throw out a couple of plugs. I still got a beer. It's the badass Broken Skull IPA, the finest IPA in the United States of America, and that's the bottom line. Made by El Segundo Brewing Company. You can find Broken Skull IPA at Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live in Cali. If you ain't in Cali, you're probably SOL. And if you're looking to get a badass pocket knife, I got two for you. Cold Steel Broken Skull Knife, Cold Steel Working Man Knife. Get them at my Amazon store, amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin, or go to the Cold Steel Knives website and check out all their badass knives. Also, one more big shout out to all my sponsors to make this show possible. That's how I'm able to bring this show to you free twice a week. Please support them because they support us. For more info, check out the podcast description to this episode for details. Folks, I am on social media, Twitter and Instagram, at Steve Austin BSR. Folks, I'll be back soon, but until then, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.